bullets for people over there.
Well, today we said we would talk about thermodynamics. This is one of the more important theoretical subjects relating to the field of chemistry, but it also relates to other fields, physics, mechanical engineering, even certain aspects of it apply to electrical engineering. Geologists can use it. In fact, science in general can use the subject of thermodynamics. Now, I said the theoretical subject. Actually, thermodynamics is a very practical subject. People who design engines, be they automobile, aircraft, steam engines, or whatnot, in the way of engines, must use the science of thermodynamics. As a matter of fact, the science of thermodynamics had its beginnings in steam engines. People were trying to decide what you had to do to have the most efficient, most effective kind of a steam engine. And thermodynamics grew out of that. That was the big push for it. Thermodynamics is an old science. Probably had its beginnings as early as 1830. And developed rather rapidly and to a great extent before 1900 had come around. There will be some concepts that are abstract, but I think they'll only be abstract to you because you're not familiar with them. We won't explore the entire subject by any means, but we'll try and hit some of the high spots concerning it. We will relate the subject mainly to chemistry, although I do hope to consider some simple things concerning engines and how you make an engine more efficient and use thermodynamics to do that. We'll apply it to chemical reactions. A chemist in writing a general chemical reaction will say A molecules of A plus B molecules of capital B, lowercase b, molecules of capital B, plus and so on, will equal, you can use an equal sign or a single arrow, or more correctly use a double arrow, indicating that a reaction can also go the other way. These materials here would be called the reactants. And on this side, we would form C molecules of C plus B molecules of B plus whatever. And those which we write, those components of the reaction, which we write on the right-hand side, we call the products. Now, we have not written too many chemical reactions on the board. Let's write a few. Hydrogen gas can react with chlorine gas to form two molecules of hydrochloric acid gas, HCl. Now, most reactions are aided by a catalyst, and this one is. And most reactions are aided by the introduction of energy in some form. This one is aided by sunlight. We usually write that H nu to indicate radiation, electromagnetic radiation of some kind, will initiate or aid that reaction to take place. Now, this reaction, as I have written it, tells in a general way what has taken place, but it does not tell in detail. There may be things, this is the overall reaction, there may be things here that go on beforehand. And when you try to get down to the ultimate detail of a chemical reaction, you call that the mechanism of the reaction. Now, I think I remember some of the details of this reaction. I think actually what happens is the chlorine is hit by a photon, a bullet of light, and a small amount of it, just a very small amount, forms a single atom of chlorine. Now, chlorine normally comes as two atoms tied together by a chemical bond, a covalent bond, and we write that Cl2. A single atom of chlorine is very reactive, much more reactive than two atoms tied together. A single atom is more reactive. This having occurred, then one of these will attack the hydrogen and will form HCl plus a single atom of hydrogen. And a single atom of hydrogen is much more reactive than H2, two atoms together.
Okay. The photon comes from the sunlight?
Yeah. Now, that sometimes that initiates it. And once it's started, it keeps going by itself. There are all kinds of things that initiate chemical reactions. They can just sit there for a long time. You can mix hydrogen and oxygen together, stick them in a flask, people have done this, seal it off, set it away on a shelf for years, and nothing happens. But if you shine through, not sunlight, but something much more energetic, such as x-rays or ultraviolet lights, a sufficient energy will initiate the reaction and be a big explosion. Well, of course, you can do it the way they do it in an auto. You'll have a spark jump. And then a little bit of reaction is initiated, and then it proceeds so rapidly that you have an explosion. Same is true of dynamite. You just initiate the reaction of a little tiny bit of it, and enough heat and light and whatnot is developed to rapidly spread throughout the mass and have the reaction go. Well, when you get down to these details of the reaction, we call that a study of reaction mechanisms. And sometimes these details are only guessed at. But for the broader picture, eliminating the details, we would just say that in this case, one molecule of H2, or hydrogen gas, reacts with two molecules, Cl2, which is a molecule of chlorine gas, to form two molecules of HCl gas. Okay?
This is just a little bit off, but you were saying when you unite hydrogen and oxygen, if you do it so fast that there's an explosion, that means energy is released.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean the mass of the product is less than the mass of the atoms?
Yes. But not by enough that you can weigh on the most sensitive chemical balance, even if you exploded a room full of it. See, when you say energy equals mc squared, it only takes a tremendously tiny amount of mass to create a fantastic amount of energy. C is a big number, the velocity of light, and you square it. And so the amount of mass that science thinks is formed or given up, whether energy is given up or taken up, is so small you cannot weigh it. Nobody's ever been able to weigh that change. Sometimes in chemical reactions, we put a parenthesis after the thing like this, indicating that that's a gas, indicating that this is a gas, indicating that this is a gas. In thermodynamics, it's usually important to know the state of matter. You know, we have the common states, gas, liquid, and solid. When chemical reactions take place, energy can be absorbed or given up. It can go both ways. In this case, energy is given up. Heat is given off in this case. Now the energy is most often given off as heat in a chemical reaction. But it need not be. There are chemical reactions in which some of the energy is given off as visible light. There are complicated organic systems in which that can occur. In some instances, there may be chemical reactions take place where electromagnetic radiation of radio frequency is given off, radio waves. There may be electricity given off. See, a battery is a chemical reaction in which most of the energy is given off as an electric current. An electric current can run a motor, starting motor, for example, in your automobile. So the energy may be given off in various forms, or energy may be absorbed. You may have to heat some substances to make the chemical reaction go. You can do the reverse of a battery and plate copper out, as they do with the smelter, from a solution. So you take electrical energy in to make the chemical reaction go. And in some cases, the reaction may be caused to go by radiant energy of some kind, striking the atoms involved. Well, the point I want to make is that, the main point I want to make is that energy might be given off or it might be absorbed in a chemical reaction. Another point that needs to be made is that the reaction can go this way, and in some instances it will go essentially 100% in the direction you have written. But in some cases, depending on circumstance, the reaction may go the other way. And in the usual sense, particularly with organic reactions, there's a stalemate. The reaction will go part way. And when the reaction goes part way, we say we have an equilibrium. Say we start out with only this material. And we let it react and it goes just part way here and then it quits. That's called an equilibrium. If the equilibrium is way over on this side, then for practical purposes you can leave this off and just write an arrow indicating that for practical purposes, all of this reaction, all of that, yield all of this, with essentially none of this left behind. But for most reactions, that is not true, particularly in the world of organic chemistry. Now, there are other complications. You may have a side reaction, and something else may be formed. That would not be true with this. But there may be something else formed, a side reaction, that's called. And in the world of organic chemistry, there may be several side reactions. So here's this chemist working at Sharp and Dohme or Eli Lilly Company or some drug company. And he wants to make some important medicinal drug. He may have to go through as many as 10 different reactions to get what he wants. Because almost always there will be a side reaction and there will be an equilibrium such that he doesn't get the entire thing going to the product. So he has to sort out his chemicals. He lets the reaction take place. I can describe that like this, I guess. A plus B gives him some C plus D, but it doesn't react completely. He still has A and B left. It also over here gives him some E, and it may even give him some product F. It may be an H or something like that. Well, look, he really wants E. But he has to get rid of C and D and the reactants that are still left, A and B, and F and H. And he has to purify and separate out this component. And then that was just an intermediate. Now he has to take E and react it with J. And again, there's an equilibrium. He gets K and maybe he gets some L and some M and so on. And the fact that drugs are expensive is made too much of by politicians. Politicians are always that way. I get so mad at politicians. They're an adversary. They're always trying to create a bad relationship. The business is bad, you know, work for the poor. And they pit the black man against the white, the poor against the rich, and business against this. They're just always this adversary thing. So they attack the drug companies. Well, there isn't a company in the United States that manages to make more than 10%. The very best company, 10% on its investment. And well, the heck, you can go down to savings bank and make that kind of money. people used to invest in businesses because you could make more money in the business than you could by putting it in the savings bank. But it's not that way anymore. So people used to invest in the stock market because they hope to make money off the company. Now they invest in the stock market because they hope to make money on the sale of the stock. They don't care what happens to the company. Which is a bad thing. And our politicians have created that during the past 40 years. But, you know, you may not get this in the other classes, so I'll tell you about it in chemistry. Say you're a corporation. I'm a big, giant, bad corporation in the eyes of the politicians who want to get themselves elected by saying that they're against corporations and for the people. Well, Canada General Electric Company, I make $100 million profit that year, which on my investment may only be 3 or 4%, which is ridiculous, you know, for having that much invested in plant and equipment and whatnot. All right, what happens to that write-off? How much of this goes as federal income tax write-off? 48%. 48%. 48 million of that 100 million goes to the U.S. government right off the top. Boy, isn't that a deal? I didn't invest in the company. I had nothing to do with it. Not a darn thing. But whatever money it makes, I take 48%. Okay, what does the average state take in income tax from the corporation? The average state takes 10%. Okay, there's 10. Okay, see, 58% has gone just in one kind of taxes, the corporate income tax. Big, bad business. The government really wants those companies to make money. It's just dirty, low talk. They really want the company to make money, because the more money the company makes, the bigger the take the federal government gets.
Do all corporations pay this tax, or do some have deductions?
Every corporation pays that. Every corporation pays that. Well, a capital gain that a corporation makes is nil. See, a capital gain is if you make an investment and then hold that investment for more than 6 months and then sell it, then you're only taxed at half the rate. But corporations don't make investments. I mean, they may make an investment in their own company by buying equipment and materials, but that's not counted as a capital investment. Capital investments are investors playing the stock market. Those are the guys who, until recently, you know, they did real well in the market. But, you know, this is only the beginning of things. This is on the profit. But prior to taking out this profit, these guys have paid various kinds of franchise taxes. I know these things because I've been in business for the past 7 years. Boy, it really gets to you. 17. I hired one guy, one BYU student, part-time, half-time. And at the end of the year, I was hit with 17 government documents I had to file. Stacked that high, no less. For hiring a guy, the minute you hire a guy, you're into it. You're into it. They paid franchise taxes, property taxes, sales taxes. They pay 5.85% on every employee's wage as their contribution to the Social Security tax. They pay 3% in federal unemployment tax, and usually the state will hit them for about 2% federal unemployment tax. The state of Utah, most states hit an employer for an accident insurance thing, and now Kennedy wants to put all health insurance, you know, on top of the employer. Why? Talk about socialism. We're more socialistic than the Russians. What got me off on the line? The drug companies, the high profits of the drug companies. I say baloney. It's true that the drugs are rather expensive, but what they have to go through to get many of those drugs, and the research that has to go into them,
they deserve to make a high profit for a while. Be patient. When a drug is new, maybe it ought to cost $15 for two pills. But as time goes by, the price will go down, but they need to. They may have been 20 years developing that drug. They may have spent up to $1 million. And you need to take that into account. You can kill a company if you don't allow it enough funds to do research. Question back there?
Yes,
yes, we're off the track. We're way off it already, so yeah, go ahead.
Our neighbor, Dr. Castle, lots of times complains that the Food and Drug Administration won't allow a lot of new chemicals to go on the market.
Yeah.
So is that a problem for the chemical?
Oh, it's a real problem. We will, progress has really slowed down because all such congressmen as D'Addario, who got the D'Addario law passed, which says if you can cause cancer in a laboratory animal by using any amount of the material, then you cannot use that drug on human beings. Have I talked about that law before?
Yeah.
Okay. It's those kind of things. We live in a world where our lawmakers are taking the attitude that there can be no risk. We're going to protect everybody. You know, we're not only going to feed and clothe them, but we're going to protect them. We're going to protect them from any harm. Well, heck, that really takes the fun out of life. Are you? There has to be some hazard to this life. I think the Lord intended for there to be some hazard. But if you take no risk, you'll never have any gain, and you'll probably just slide backwards.
I think that's really evident what they've done with the car makers the last few years.
Oh,
they
yeah.
The equipment they put on the cars. I wonder how many people here who really wear the shoulder harness when they drive.
No, maybe we don't have
any. Is that true? Are you buzzing? Screams?
And the buzzes for the, how many really appreciate the buzzer for the key? How many appreciate the buzzer in doors and
all? Well, they don't. And of course,
the price.
The problem is, the current philosophy, nobody is willing to wait anymore. Everybody's impatient. The lawmakers want to do it now, you know, whether they're ready for it or not. We're going to do it now. By 1975, you have to have certain emission standards. Whether it's realistic or unrealistic, they don't care. The guys who make the laws probably don't know. And furthermore, men are not smart enough to see down the road. It's the same way with social legislation, see? You have to have the wisdom of God to know what's going to happen. And those guys assume they have that wisdom, but they really haven't. There are big questions. We see it in the chemical journals before you see it in the newspapers as a rule, but there are big questions now about the catalytic converter. We may in the end do more harm than good because it oxidizes the sulfur compounds that are present in gasoline. And so we're increasing the SO2 concentration of the atmosphere. Well, is that good? Nobody really knows, see? So they insist on things before we know the total effects. They insisted on lead-free gasoline without even knowing whether lead was harmful or not. And lead apparently is not harmful. What the heck? We've been putting tetraethyl lead in gasoline since 1925. We've had it for, it was 25%, 50 years? 50 years of burning lead in gasoline, and there's no evidence that it's done us much harm. Nor has it done us any harm. But suddenly they decide no more lead in gasoline. Well, that makes you burn more gasoline, you see. And the sad thing about the anti-pollution laws is that your automobile now burns 20% more gasoline than it used to. So you take the pollutants out, but there's more gasoline being burned, so you're about back where you started, see. Because the more, even though the pollutant per gallon is less, now you're burning more gasoline, so there'll be additional pollution just because you're burning more gasoline.
Now, what exactly does the catalytic converter do? Does it take out nitric oxide?
No, not hydrogen? At the present time. It takes out unburned hydrocarbons.
Well, it seems like to me that I read an article where it said that real dangerous thing in the pollution was the nitric oxides that are coming out. And everything they've done to cut down pollution has aimed at the hydrocarbons and we've only increased the nitric oxides.
Yeah, and it, when we get into the thermodynamics of engines, the higher a temperature can, at which an engine can run, the more efficient it is. But when you get to real high temperatures in engines, then the nitrogen, which just goes through the system without doing much good, gets burned at the high temperature to an oxide of nitrogen. And it's one of the things responsible for the real bad smog like you get in Los Angeles. The only real cure for the thing is to make us quit using automobiles as much. And they really should, Congress really should let Ford slap that tax on. In fact, we probably ought to slap a tax on that would make gasoline cost $1.50 a gallon. It's the only way that you and I will ever cut down on our driving. And that's the only ultimate solution. Everything else you do is wasteful. It costs money and it takes energy to make a catalytic converter. I suppose automobiles cost $500 more. A standard Chevy probably costs $500 more on account of the gadgets that all the various do-gooders have insisted be put on the things the past 5 or 6 years. But the only thing that really will cure it is to cut down on the automobile itself by about 20 or 30%.
I have a 74 car, so it has a buzzer on it that, screams at you if you don't close your seatbelt, And the first 5,000 miles, the only thing that went wrong with the car is that you couldn't get the seatbelt to lift. So, it's really stupid. You could never shut off that buzzer, so you just disconnect.
Yeah. Well, lots of guys, as soon as they get a new car, immediately disconnect the buzzer.
Yeah.
Well, the reason they take the lead out of gas is because the lead is exhaust, wipes out the catalytic converter.
Yeah.
That's the only reason that they took the lead out of gasoline.
Well, that's the only reason the manufacturers did. The government was getting rid of lead on the grounds that it was harmful. As a matter of fact, the Ethyl Corporation, which is the large manufacturer of that, took it to court and won their suit on that aspect. The government had not proved that lead was harmful. And the Tetraethyl Lead Corporation, which I guess has lost millions of dollars on this, did win the suit, but it didn't. I don't think the government paid them anything for their loss.
I'm just thinking the stuff you told us is such good ideas. I think you ought to run for senator and we could all vote for you.
Well, I don't know. The funny thing about politics, conservative guys go in there and pretty soon they're liberal. I guess you have to do it to get elected. I've seen several editorials recently, I don't know where it all started, that what the American public really should start to do is anytime anybody has been in more than two terms, vote him out. Whether he's good, bad, or indifferent, just get rid of him. And if we do that, things would probably change. The thing that has corrupted our politicians is the fact that they want to get reelected every year. Every year they want to get elected, And so they say what the only thing on their minds, as near as I can tell, is to get elected. That is the big deal. As a matter of fact, that's what they teach in the political science right here at BYU. It really drives me. Any of you in poli-science? The object of the game is to get elected, and that's the whole story. Nothing else matters. The Republican Party's objective is to get men elected, and the Democrats' Party, the job is to get them elected. And you don't talk about principles or anything else. The object is to get elected. But if the American public would just say, okay, Mosh, you've been in for 12 or 14 or 16 years, whatever it is, and that's three times too long. I don't care who's running against you next year, I'm going to vote for him. I think things would change for the better if we did it. In fact, we ought to pass laws that nobody can be in for more than two terms. That's what we ought to do.
Yes, the president. Then he has like a 1 6- or 7-year term.
One term of 6 years for president. Senator and congressman would be a great deal because then you wouldn't.
You don't have a lame duck president.
I suppose,
as soon as he gets elected for a second term, he's lame.
Well, let's go back to thermodynamics after that detour. Thermodynamics is involved in that problem. If you're far enough along, when you start talking about entropy and relate it to this sociological problem.
Not really wrong.
What I want to do next is to give you a mental picture of a chemical reaction from the standpoint of energy. Now, this is just a mental picture. It doesn't exactly relate too much to reality, but it's a practical picture of a chemical reaction. This coordinate represents increasing energy, which I'll just represent at the moment by E, standing for energy. This represents a more abstract kind of an idea. This is the progress of the chemical reaction. The reactants are located in a valley. Maybe Happy Valley, like that. So let's say this is A molecules of A. We're just talking in general now. You see, a chemist does this to talk in general terms about a reaction without being specific. A molecules of A plus B molecules of B plus whatever. Those are our reactants. Now, just as water can settle into a basin or in a valley and stay there, a chemical reaction can be regarded as being in this valley, in this energy valley right here. Now, there is a hill between that valley and another valley over here. And over in this valley, we have the reactants, which consists of C molecules of C and B molecules of D, and so on.
You mean the products?
Yeah, sorry, products. Now, chemical reactants cannot be compared exactly to water, but the idea is that here is a valley where things are at rest and they're protected from getting over into this valley by a mountain in between. The water, you'd have to dig a tunnel through here, so to speak, you see, for the water run down to the lower energy. Now, there is a law concerning energy in science that says that things that are in a higher energy state will do their best, whatever they can do, to try and get to the lower energy state. So you see, I have drawn my products in a lower valley, a lower energy state than over here. So these products would like to go to this lower energy state, but they can't do it on account of this hill, which separates the valley. Now, in chemistry, atoms and molecules do not have just one single energy, however. There's a whole range of energies. Now, we're speaking mainly of the energy of the electrons, because it's the electrons, the outer electrons, that are important for chemical bonds. We do not know the total energy of an atom, but we can know the relative energies of atoms, and this is associated with the outer electrons which participate in a chemical bonding. Now, the average energy of this collection of atoms or molecules or whatever it is that I'm reacting together could be represented by a single line right through here. And the average energy of these products could be represented by a single line here. But actually, there's a range of energies, and these energies are quantized. Now, that's a new word. I guess I'll have to backtrack and tell you what we mean by quantize. Before 1900, when people thought of energy, they thought that energy of an atom or a molecule could assume any value. That is, it could have, in chemistry, we speak of energy often in terms of calories, and that's carried over into foods. So you say you eat so many calories a day and you'll get fatter. I wish I could lose a pound, so I'm only going to eat so many calories a day. We're talking about the same kind of calories. It's the energy in the food, and our body, in a sense, is a chemical and partly a mechanical system, and we burn the food, and the food, we're an engine, so to speak. From that food, it's our gasoline, we can do our work and our thinking and whatnot. Well, we talk about those same kind of calories in chemical reactions. Well, you would think you could have one calorie of energy, or 1.1, or 1.200, going out to 9. That is, just any range of energy was thought to be okay. But with the study of line spectra, and I knew there was another reason why I brought those lamps in here that day. You remember those lamps that I had here that showed different colors? Now, those lines, those rays of light, represent energy states of the electrons in the atoms, possible energy states. And you cannot have just any old energy. There are discrete energies. For example, a hydrogen atom, single alone. If we plotted its energy on a chart like this, here's increasing energy. Be an energy here, an energy there, and there, and there, and there. Discrete energy levels. No continuous range of energies available for the one electron connected with the hydrogen atom. There are discrete states, we would say. Discrete energy states that the electron can have. Well, that's called quantized states. When we speak of things being quantized, we mean, and we're usually speaking of electrons, although we need not be, we can be speaking of other kinds of things, discrete energy states only are possible. Now, the more complicated a molecule, the closer these get together. If we were talking about an NH3, which now contains 4 atoms, there would be many more states, but still they are discrete. There's an energy in here which the molecule simply cannot have. Just cannot have such an energy. But now that we have this kind of a molecule, we can have more than electronic energy. There could be energy of rotation of that molecule, energy of the stretching of the NH3 bonds, vibrations, rotations, all kinds of things, which are down in the infrared and lower energy states. The electrons have the highest energy states, and rotations of molecules and stretching of molecules, atoms in molecules, stretching of the bond just like it was a spring, and that occurs. We'll have the lower energy states down in here, and they'll tend to be closer together than the electronic energy states. Well, our collection of molecules up here will have these energy states. And while the average energy will be some energy down in here, there are energies that are up here high enough that the water could run over the top of the hill and go down here, so to speak. And there's a general principle, not always true, but true about 90% of the time. If you heat something, then you get the higher energy states. You get up here in higher energy states, and there's more of a chance of the chemical reaction going. There's a rule of thumb I may have told you before in organic chemistry. If you increase the temperature by 5 degrees, your chemical reaction will go twice as fast. Now, organic chemicals are subject to high temperatures, though, and there's a limit to how high you can heat them because you'll decompose the material you're working with, or do something like you do to eggs. You heat an egg too high a temperature, it's not an egg anymore. It's not fluid, you know, it turns into a white solid and a yellow thing in the center that's also solid.
Is that polymerization?
Yeah, that's polymerization in that case. And it's an irreversible one.
you can't get the egg back the way it was before, at least not easily. I have to take it apart, atom and by atom, and then put it back together. It's splinterized in three dimensions.
Which type of polymer would you like?
Now, likewise, though, over here we can have a whole bunch of quantized energy states. But notice that the distance from here to there is a greater distance than the distance from here to there. So if we have the situation where the reactants have a higher level than the products, we could make the statement as chemists, this would be our statement number one, the reaction has thermodynamic permission to take place. Reaction can go. Shortcut, but what this really means is that from a thermodynamic point of view, this reaction can take place. Chemists, however, have to answer two kinds of questions. The next question a chemist would say, after he asks if the reaction can go, he says, how fast will it go? Will it take a billion years? Will it go in a second? Will it go in a minute or an hour? Chemists can answer the first question rather well nowadays, and every chemical company will have an expert in thermodynamics on their staff. Oh, more than one expert. DuPont will have a half a dozen thermodynamicists, very skilled in their field, who can answer that first question. And that's an important question because there are many starting materials you could use to make nylon. You have to consider economics, you have to consider thermodynamics. And they'll have both kind of guys there looking at all those problems. A good thermodynamicist will also know economics so he can do both jobs. You have to integrate all of these things together. We can do this well. Thermodynamics is a well-developed science, and we can answer that question quite well. But this one, we do poorly. This is a much tougher question to answer. How fast will the reaction go? In answering the first question, we only have to deal with energies. In answering the second question, we have to deal with energies and time, and that additional variable of time. And time is a mysterious thing anyway. It's very difficult to answer. Now, the world's experts in this field, even though we do it poorly, we do have some experts in the field. It's the Latter-day Saint by the name of Henry Irons. You've probably heard of him. For many years, he was dean of the graduate school at the University of Utah. He's about 73 years old now. He's a distinguished professor of chemistry and metallurgy there, but he no longer has his administrative responsibilities. He has published something like 600 papers in the field of reaction rates. And he is the developer of what is called the theory of absolute reaction rates. Theory of absolute reaction rates. Irons was born down in old Mexico. He takes great pleasure in calling himself a Mexican. Of course, down in the Mormon colonies, and they were driven out by Pancho Villa, you know, about, when did that happen?
1910, somewhere around there.
And like many other Mormons, they settled in Arizona. Now, he was farming and that kind of stuff. He had a good German background, and the Germans, gotta say it for the Germans, they're usually pretty smart. high intelligence among the Germans. He came through a line of people that were in the science of the day, people who tanned leather and things like that. They worked with chemicals. Well, they farmed there in Arizona, but somehow he did go to school, and he went into metallurgy. I guess it was mining, really. He went into mining first. He's going to be a mining engineer. And first time he went down a mine shaft, he got hit on the head with a rock. So when he got back up the shaft again, he decided he wasn't going to be a mining engineer, and he went into metallurgy. I'm just telling the story the way he tells it. And then he went to a smelter. But the SO2 fumes were so darn strong around the smelter that he decided he didn't want to be a metallurgist. And so then he decided he'd be a chemist. But he didn't. Every time he'd go in the lab, he'd break all the glassware. And so finally he decided, well, I'll be a theoretical chemist.
He used theoretical glass.
So he went, I guess he went to Wisconsin, and from Wisconsin he went to Berkeley. He had a fellowship in Germany of some kind, an important fellowship. And he got in with the German theoretical chemists, some of the important names I've forgotten at this time, but he got off on this theoretical kick and finally ended up as a teacher of chemistry at Princeton. Now, Princeton and name schools like that are always on the alert for first-class guys, and Sir Hugh Taylor, who was dean of the graduate school at Princeton, heard Iring at an American Chemical Society meeting present a paper on this subject of reaction rates, and he picked him up right away. Now, Iring was there for a while, and then the University of Utah, which had not had a PhD program, tried to get hold of him and succeeded in getting him away from there in 1945. Now, Iring didn't want to come back. He didn't want to come to Utah. Too podunk for him. But his wife hit him over the head with a club, the way he tells it anyway. Made him come back. He wouldn't have come back, but to keep his happy home, he had to on account of his wife. Well, I was Iring's first student after he came back to the University of Utah. The University of Utah was in the habit of sending its guys away to such schools as Purdue. Purdue was real popular, and they sent me to Purdue when the war was over. And when I got back there, there was no housing, absolutely no housing. I was married and had two kids. And they promised housing. I went back alone, and just no housing. And I stayed 6 weeks and could see there will just never be any housing. They said, well, leave your wife and kids for a year or two. So what? Well, what the heck? I'd already been in the armed services for 2 years without them, and I wasn't going to have any more of that. So I started looking around for another place to go to school. And finally, when the Purdue prof says, well, heck, he says, with Iring out at Utah, that's a better school than Purdue anyway. Why don't you go right back where you came from? So I went back.